Hello, I'm Sunny Morrison. This is number 0112, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0112. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, another visit from Bart King. He's the author of yet another book. This one is called Cute, A Guide to All Things Adorable. How do you know when something is cute?
Well, I guess the quick answer to that would be the things that make you say, ah. I don't need to, I guess, get too analytical about it, but anything that brings up that impulse in it, whether we express it or not. And it's sort of like the old U.S. Supreme Court definition of pornography from years past. We know it when we see it.
Stephen Paul Leyva is the author of the sci-fi book entitled Traveling in Space. It's a first contact story from the aliens' point of view, and the aliens are not here for the usual reasons you find in sci-fi.
They usually come in two ways. The aliens are here to either eat you, rape your women, or steal your water or something like that. Or they come to Earth to uplift you into some nirvana or some place where you're no longer warring on each other and you're nice, wonderful people. And I take kind of a different tack than that. My aliens stumble upon Earth. They weren't looking for it. And they are scientists.
Sandra Phillips and Stan Posner are the authors of Drive I-95. They're back on the show with an update of their book. After all these years of doing this book, is it difficult to find new things on each fact-finding trip?
We are flabbergasted by the new things we find each time. We sort of had done the highlights of Richmond, Virginia, and there was a museum sort of we hadn't got to yet. It was a science museum for kids. So we went there, figured, oh, it'll take us 45 minutes to go through and get some notes. And the PR lady says, if you wait till 11 a.m., you could watch the rats playing basketball.
And we did, and there's a video on my site.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0112, is Sunny Morrison, who is the HR administrator at Global Montreal, the other place that I work. Thank you very much, Sunny, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, a Bettendorf, Iowa businessman branded as the boss from hell by some of his employees is in hot water after he offered prizes to workers who could predict which of them would be fired next. Apparently, 57-year-old William Ernst, the owner of the Bettendorf-based chain of convenience stores called QC Mart, sent all of his employees a memo in March outlining a contest in which the workers were encouraged to participate. The memo read, "New contest, guess the next cashier who will be fired. To win our game, write on a piece of paper the name of the next cashier you believe will be fired. Write their name, today's date, today's time, and your name. Seal it in an envelope and give it to the manager to put in my envelope." Ernst then sent secret shoppers to his stores looking for cashiers violating company policies like wearing a hat, talking on a cell phone, not wearing a QC Mart shirt, having someone hanging around behind the counter, and or having a personal car parked by the pumps after 7 p.m., among other things. The winner of each contest was to receive $10 in cash. Wow. With the stipulation of only one winner per firing, unless there are multiple right answers with the exact same name, date, and time. Ernst told employees, "Once we fire the person, we will open all the envelopes, award the prize, and start the contest again." Sounds like fun, doesn't it? Yeah. QC Mart cashier Misty Shelsky was shocked by the memo and says Ernst had a long history of unprofessional conduct with regard to low-ranking workers. She and her store manager, along with a few other employees, quit as soon as they saw the memo and realized it wasn't a joke. Ernst then fought Shelsky when she applied for unemployment benefits. But administrative law judge Susan D. Ackerman sided with the workers, calling the contest egregious and deplorable. Ackerman said the employer's actions have clearly created a hostile work environment by suggesting its employees turn on each other for a minimal monetary prize. This was an intolerable and detrimental work environment. Shelsky got her unemployment benefits, and Ernst isn't commenting. Well, as I've said many, many times, boss spelt backwards is double S-O-B. So there you have it. Elsewhere, 35-year-old Russian teacher Alex Karpenko is making headlines after it was discovered he saves money on razor blades by shaving daily with a garden spade instead. Alex, who teaches English, says he was taught how to shave with everyday objects by his Second World War veteran grandfather. Back in the day, he used a sharpened axe, but now uses a spade, saying, "Razors are an expensive, unnecessary luxury. My grandfather told me that during the war he used to shave using anything." Alex does admit, "When my wife first saw me standing in the bathroom with an axe to my throat, she was pretty horrified, so I decided to hang up the axe and use a sharpened shovel instead. I think it's probably a bit safer." Yeah, and that also brings cheap to a new level. Moving right along, the image of President Barack Obama dressed as Colonel Sanders is being used to advertise a fried chicken restaurant in Beijing called Obama Fried Chicken. The billboards display the president in suspenders and bow tie with the tagline, "We're so cool, aren't we?" The Obama Fried Chicken restaurant could be a response to the U.S. filing a complaint with the World Trade Organization about Chinese tariffs on American chicken exports. Of course, there are the obvious copyright infringement questions against KFC, but that kind of depends on what copyright laws are enforceable in communist China. Maybe the Chinese have something of an Obama chicken obsession? Earlier this year in Hong Kong, an Obama lookalike was employed to advertise an actual KFC restaurant. But even in China, some have complained the name plays into old racial stereotypes. And as I've said on this program time and time again, you know, China really hasn't come across a copyright law that they haven't found a way to ignore. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, it's probably a good idea to just make it a personal blanket policy to never utter the words, "Well, why don't you just shoot me?" In Los Angeles, two friends were drinking in a parked car in the backyard of a residence when an argument broke out. At one point, one of the men did say, "Well, why don't you just shoot me?" So his friend did, in the head, killing him. The alleged shooter has been arrested. The victim, who was believed to be in his mid-20s, died while undergoing surgery. The suspect is in his 30s, and neither of the men's names have been released. Well, I guess there's the ultimate last wish, don't you think? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this week's edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Bart King is back on the program again. He's a rather prolific author who has written such books as The Big Book of Girl Stuff, The Big Book of Spy Stuff, The Big Book of Gross Stuff, The Pocket Guide to Mischief, just to name a few. His latest book is called Cute, A Guide to All Things Adorable. Bart joins us on the line via Skype-to-Skype communications. Hi, Bart.
Hey, Peter.
Nice to have you back on the show again. So the big, A Guide to All Things Adorable...
Yeah, I know. It feels like there should be a size there, like the teeny-weeny cute guide to all things adorable. But yeah, it's an investigation into all things cute.
Now, first of all, isn't that rather subjective? As they say, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. Isn't cute similar to that, too?
You know, that's true. What was fun researching this book was looking at the kind of the prism of cuteness that we see the world through, and then trying to parse out which parts are cultural, you know, which parts are sort of more visceral. Psychology plays a role, obviously upbringing, family culture is really important. So trying to pull it apart, but of course it does vary, but I mean, you know, LOL Cats teaches us that apparently some things have a universal appeal. So well, at least, you know, among some cultures.
First of all, how do you even define cute?
Well, I guess the quick answer to that would be the things that make you say, ah, you know, and I think that you know, as a child, we have this sort of unguarded, no defense mechanism against responding to cute things. There's no reason not to. As we get older, especially for men, I think those guards kind of come into play because, you know, what teenage boy wants his friends to see him, you know, getting crazy over a bunny rabbit. But nonetheless, I argue the impulse, the feeling is there. The person has just learned to guard guard that kind of reaction, especially if friends, peers are around. I don't need to get too analytical about it, but anything that brings up that impulse in it, whether we express it or not, and it's sort of like the old Supreme Court definition, U.S. Supreme Court definition of pornography from years past. We know it when we see it, you know.
Yet on the other side of the coin, it seems to be that there are some people who, as you age, the definition of cute changes, and it also almost becomes an insult. I mean, when you're a teenager and you see a girl and she's cute,
right?
That's really a high compliment. But if you're older and you see a woman and you say she's cute, she might be offended, saying, "Well, I'm not beautiful."
She may be. That is true. What's interesting to know is that I think that for little kids, being called cute is just kind of part of the territory, right? You don't see 5-year-olds bridling at being called cute. They're used to it. At some point in adolescence, especially, again, I think for men, you don't want to be called cute by your relatives whom you see maybe annually. But at some point, I'll just speak from the male perspective, you don't mind being called cute as long as it's not in a patronizing way. And speaking of patronizing, I mean, there is a chapter that I devote to senior citizen cute. I argue that it's perfectly fine for senior citizens can qualify as being cute, as can anyone in any age category. It's obviously a lot easier for younger kids. But you have to be wary of doing that kind of patronizing. The cute little old lady, you know, I think that's probably the most potentially offensive thing that we can trot out. You don't often hear the cute little old man epithet. But I suppose that's out there as well.
Well, what led to this book in the first place?
You know, it sounds odd, but the Big Book of Gross Stuff, which is one of my vile volumes from a couple of years ago, kind of led me down this path of thinking about, well, first of all, I know that there's a built-in interest factor for younger readers with gross stuff. And then getting them and myself to think about, well, what is it that makes something gross? You know, again, is it cultural? Are we raised that way? Or are there times when no matter, you know, where in the world we, or even in terms of history, where in time we might have been brought up, would we still have the same kind of pull away revulsion to certain things? And so that book was an exploration of that. Seeing how kids responded to book presentations to gross stuff was very interesting, because there was, again, usually a built-in interest factor, even if, or even maybe a built-in revulsion factor to the book. But it was just interesting to see that powerful, visceral connection. And so I just kind of thought, well, what's the flip side of that? You know, and for my readers who tend to be maybe 8 to 13 years of age, or immature readers of any age, I thought cuteness was probably it, you know. And I think when I present to kids now and I talk about cuteness, I'll often talk about cuteness as being the flip side of the coin to gross stuff. You know, they both bring about these powerful reactions from us. They're opposite reactions in a lot of ways, but nonetheless, you know, it's really fun to kind of unspool that strand and figure out, okay, why is it that we're acting the way that we are? You know, can we trace this back to some cause effects?
Is there something wrong with people in society if they don't see cute the same way others? I mean, you know, one person's cute baby is another person's miniature Winston Churchill.
Well, I think, yeah, that's really funny. I think for me, the idea of twee, you know, the cuteness that goes too far when people, I think it's an issue of trying too hard with cuteness. And so when I see a baby girl, for example, maybe a relative newborn, let's say 3 months old, she's cute. She doesn't need any help. The more pastel colors, if it's a girl, particularly pink, that the parents employ, the less they're doing to enhance the child's cuteness. The worst of all for me is putting a headband on a baby that just has a few wisps of hair, or, you know, horror of horrors, tying a colorful ribbon around, like kind of pulling the queue of hair together at the top of the head and trying to pull it together with a little ribbon there. It's like, to what end? You know what I mean? That's what I would call twee. And I think professional baby photographers are the worst offenders of this kind, you know, where they'll take a perfectly cute, normal, healthy child and then surround it with, you know, rose petals and kittens and pumpkins. I mean, you know, things that are supposed to enhance, but in fact only ultimately detract from the cuteness. Also kind of along these lines, maybe to pull back for a larger view, I think just like every person has a different appetite for sweets, you know, most of us have some kind of, you know, we relish sweet flavors, you know. For some of us, that means we're candy freaks, and for others, we might enjoy the periodic, you know, sweet thing. I think people have a similar attitude towards cuteness. We all respond to it. We have different appetites for it. And I think that's true culturally, too. I think in North America, what I found anyway was that as you sort of compare cultures, North Americans typically have a pretty high appetite for cute stuff. Other cultures, not so much. Far East, Middle East cultures have a far lesser appetite. Although I should point out, actually, the far, far East, if we go to Japan, I mean, that's probably the world's capital of insatiable, outsized appetite for cute stuff there that far exceeds even, you know, say, Canada or the U.S. So that was also kind of interesting, seeing that comparison, that that appetite for cuteness comparison.
Well, those places that don't seem to have a high cute quotient, why do you think that is?
Well, you know, this is, I thought that I would have a really charming chapter talking about the culture of cute. And I realized that I started writing the chapter, it ended up getting cut, because it's tough to talk about that without it sounding like a value judgment. But I think the idea of giving in to our more tender emotions, you know, if you're in a culture where that's encouraged, then you'll have a high appetite for cuteness. If you're in a culture where strength, you know, rugged individualism of sort of almost a fierce form is promoted. Also, you know, in a weird way, I think that, and I don't, this isn't something I've explored to the point where I can trot out statistics for you, but I think that if you look at people's attitudes towards animals, the ethical treatment of animals, how kind the culture is to animals, and that's the whole stratum, you know, whether we're talking about meat eating or animals in the wild, you know, the more tenderly culture tends to treat animals, I think you would find a corresponding appetite for cuteness. I guess I'll leave it at that. With that. I don't want to.
But don't get me wrong. I think a picture of I think a picture of cute little piglets is just that. It's cute.
Right.
Doesn't prevent me from eating them when they get older.
Fair enough.
Now, how hard did you work and you and the publishers work at making the cover of cute?
Well, it's funny, you know, I think that in the contractually, the idea is that I would be consulted about illustrations and the cover. And so I was most interested in the illustrations corresponding and lining up with what I was writing about. I didn't want to seem like a control freak, so I let the cover kind of go its own way. And what I was pleased about was that they did not choose to issue the cover in a pink cover color, which would have been the most obvious choice, you know, right? It's a book about cuteness, let's make it pink. So I'm pleased they didn't go in the obvious direction. Also, you know, the fact is that pink itself has kind of an interesting history. I mean, we think of it as a girl's color, which isn't the case at all. I mean, you know, in North America, boys and girls, typically up through the 1800s, up till about the age of 5, would wear white, you know, oftentimes dresses. So boys, I mean, you've seen these before, I'm sure. You know, we have funny pictures of many of our presidents wearing white dresses as children. And they're always hilarious because you think these poor kids had to wear dresses, but it was normal for them. It wasn't really until the turn of the century, the 19th to the 20th century, that with advances in color dyeing for fabrics, that the idea of having a differentiated color for boys and girls came about. And at that time then, so we're now in the early 20th century, the idea was that red or crimson was a strong masculine color. Therefore, the diluted version of that, pink, would be the boys' color. And girls got baby blue, for other reasons which I won't bore you with. So you really, up until the mid-20th century, you know, what you find in a lot of North America was that pink was a boy's color, you know, and it's amazing to me how quickly we forget, but that's a fact, and people are amazed, you know, pink was a boy's color. They think that, you know, today many people have the misapprehension that there's this visceral connection that girls have to pink. Well, that's not the case at all. In fact, if you look at a lot of the Disney films, that were put out about that time, you know, Sleeping Beauty, I'm thinking of Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan, I think was 1953. These all have, the girls all wear baby blue in those, and that's kind of their default, you know, feminine girl color. So anyway, this is a long answer to your question about the cover of my book, which is baby blue. That does not mean it's a boy's book nor a girl's book. It does mean that I'm pleased it's not simply pink, like seems to be the default setting.
But it is cute. Cute, a guide to all things adorable.
It is, yes.
Yet another book out there, Bart, you keep churning them out. I thank you once again for being on the program with us.
Peter, you're very kind. Thank you for the invitation. I much appreciate it.
Bart King, author of Cute, a guide to all things adorable. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0112, and you'll find links to Bart's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
In the air on China Airlines, on the air on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll touch base with Stephen Paul Leyva, the author of Traveling in Space, plus the authors of Drive I-95 are back on the program with the latest edition of their book. And of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day, but right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. And here are three similar stories we've put together that we like to call Sorry, Honey, I Was Aiming at the Dog. Betty Walker allegedly firing at the pit bull that she saw lunging at some children hit the dog with one shot, and her 53-year-old husband with a second shot, killing him. That was in Jackson, Mississippi, back in July. Brent Bader allegedly firing at the family dog instead hit his wife once in the head, killing her. That's in Twin Peaks, California, back in February. And Samuel Campos, age 46, allegedly firing to put away the family chihuahua after inadvertently wounding it the day before, instead hit his girlfriend, 41, killing her instantly. That was in Willits, California, in March. I'm not going to say anything snarky here. Too many people have guns. Anyway, you don't happen to be planning a trip around the world, are you? If so, 45-year-old Deb Green of Vancouver, Canada, would like a word with you. Deb is looking for someone to fulfill the dreams of her deceased parents, a dream to see the world, and is advertising on Craigslist for worldly travelers who wouldn't mind taking some of her parents' ashes with them and sprinkling them around the globe. Her ad, entitled Helping Alice and William to Travel, reads, "Both of my parents are now dead, and the one thing they always wanted to do was to travel. If you are traveling somewhere and are willing to take a little of my mom and dad and sprinkle them and take a picture, then please contact me. If you think this is crazy, the joke's on you." Deb says, "I've had several offers and, in fact, have already had some pictures back. Alice and William are now sprinkled at the base of the Eiffel Tower and of a fountain in Las Vegas. I think they would probably blush and be a little shy about it, but they would love it." Yeah. How do these travelers explain the powder they're taking through customs with them? "Oh, these are ashes I got from a woman on Craigslist to spread at famous landmarks." Yeah, right. Security! Yeah. Moving right along, in Canberra, Australia, an ultralight two-person plane crashed into a Ferris wheel at a local fair, trapping two children on the ride and two adults in the aircraft for hours. Amazingly, there were no serious injuries. The Cheetah S200 carrying two men did not topple the Ferris wheel when it hit the frame near the top of the first morning of an annual three-day fair. Two children, a 9-year-old boy and a 13-year-old girl, were trapped in the ride car on the top of the Ferris wheel near the wrecked plane for 90 minutes. Meanwhile, the 52-year-old pilot and his 32-year-old passenger were trapped inside the mangled aircraft more than 30 feet above the ground for almost 3 hours. Rescue workers used a crane to free the four. Witnesses said the Ferris wheel was full of children minutes before the crash, but because of impending rain, only five had dared take the final ride. Brett Campbell, a paramedic at the scene, said the kids are fantastic. They were so calm and so well-behaved and so brave. And so were the two gentlemen in the plane. They were just the best patients we could ever hope for, and the best thing about it, no one really had any injuries. How would you like to be on a Ferris wheel and seeing a plane coming at you? You know, I don't think those kids were calm. I think they were in shock. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Orlando area cosmetic surgeon Jeffrey Hartog inaugurated Liquid Gold, a storehouse for patients' frozen liposuctioned fat, charging $900 to safekeep a coffee cup-sized portion and $200 per year storage, in case the fat is ever needed later for such things as smoothing facial wrinkles. Now, a Massachusetts General Hospital physician shook his head when he heard this story, saying the frozen fat doesn't hold up as well as fresh fat. And there's a tidbit of information you can share at your next cocktail party. Ooh. You know, this is a truly sad story of the fact that suckers are born every minute. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Stephen Paul Leyva has a new book out that is a unique science fiction novel. It's called Traveling in Space, and it's a first contact novel told from the point of view of the aliens. Steve joins us on the line right now via Skype to Skype communications from California. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Peter Anthony. How are you?
Oh, just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So you've written this book from the point of view of aliens.
That's right.
It's sort of like, I guess, putting a microscope on humanity. Is that basically what you're doing here?
Yeah. The my publisher, Blue Roof Press, also refers to it as a 21st century Gulliver's Travels, with the Homo sapiens as the Lilliputians. So that's exactly what I'm doing there. The aliens, and I'm also playing with a great science fiction trope, which is first contact or alien invasion stories. It's very big on TV and features, but also in novels. Now, they usually come in two ways. The aliens are here to either eat you, rape your women, or steal your water or something like that, or they come to Earth to uplift you into some nirvana or some place where you're no longer warring on each other and you're nice, wonderful people. And I take kind of a different tack than that. My aliens stumble upon Earth. They weren't looking for it. And they are scientists. They're on a huge ship, which they simply just call the Life Ship, because they refer to themselves simply as Life, because they believe they're the only life in the universe. So when they stumble upon Earth and find these other life, which they dub Other Life, that's at first a little disconcerting. But because they are scientists, essentially, they have no choice but to study the matter, to deal with the reality. And so they come down and study everybody at Earth, and they find things that they find amusing or strange or wonderful. They like a lot of what they see. But they just go about it, and so we've got their view of us, which gives me, as the author, the opportunity to look at humanity with that kind of a satirical eye that hopefully people will find entertaining and amusing.
Well, since you say they stumble upon us, obviously to get to us, some other life form would have to be a somewhat superior intelligence, but not overly superior if they didn't know we were here.
Yes, well, because the point of my aliens are to have a contrast with humanity as it is now. And these aliens are extremely bright, but they're full of quirks. They have their personality quirks. They are interesting. They have their own faults. They swear a lot, by the way. They cuss a lot. But their swearing is not based on, say, sex and excrement, but it's based on death and decay, because their main thing is they love life and they love knowledge. They hate ignorance and they hate death. But they also had this concept that, again, they were the only life. So they're out in the life ship, and they're called fact finders. They're trying to find the facts of the universe, or as Douglas Adams said in his wonderful novel, Life, the Universe, and Everything, they're trying to figure it out. So they are also looking to eventually seed a planet capable to hold life but doesn't have life, because thinking they're the matrix of life in the universe, they know they eventually have to seed to other planets and spread throughout the universe. So it really was, in a sense, that egocentric nature that led them not to even look for life anywhere else. But as they're looking for a planet that can hold life, they find a planet that has life. Now the scientists in them come out, and they feel obligated to study this life and see what it's all about. But they're not there to conquer the life, and they're not there to help the life uplift itself into some greater position.
Well, the thing about your aliens is that they have an opportunity, and by virtue, by your writing, they have an opportunity to understand our quirks, our likes, our dislikes, our way of life, everything about us, and one of the, including some of the issues that people don't like to talk about generally, or usually starts an argument, one of them being religion.
It's definitely, they have no religion themselves. They've never needed. They're a long-lived race. And they lived on a planet that the axis is pretty much aligned almost at zero with their sun. And it's kept that way because of other planets and the pull of gravity. So unlike our planet, which is tilted, which leads to not only seasons, summer and winter and the two in between, but leads to a lot of weather conditions, active weather conditions. Their planet is almost like a springtime planet. So they did not have to struggle too much to live. Gave them a lot of time to think. They took a lot of time to think. They are thousands, maybe millennium older than we are. And they have come to the point where they're, like I say, their two basic loves is both life and knowledge. They've been made extra special, if we want to put it that way. They had a master provider who was not a god, but another person thousands of years ago, who manipulated the genes in his sperm so that he could create a new species, which he does by impregnating over 8,000 women. And what he does is take the best of what he thinks they should be, and through some kind of DNA manipulation, he's done this, and there they are. They love knowledge, they love life, they hate ignorance, they hate death. They also don't have marriage. They've never had a need to get quick answers, which religions will provide. They love the questions. They love musing about the questions for a long, long time. And eventually, they're almost disappointed when they get the answers, because it kind of takes away that fun. But they accept the answers once scientifically they find out what they are. In essence, they're more mature than we are.
So you've
written
this...
what I'm really talking about. And they are, in the book, they sort of serve as a metaphor for the maturation of a species that it is my hope, and quite frankly my belief, that humans will reach for themselves. That we are a growing and maturing species, not as bad as we sometimes think we are, and that when we take on rationality, the majority of us, and when we love knowledge, love life, hate death, hate ignorance, we will find that maturity, and hopefully seed life itself throughout the universe.
Now you,
and that sounds very pretentious and pompous. It's also a funny book, I hope.
Yeah, you've written this book. You've written others as well, but you here you are talking about an aspect of the book that deals with a group of people that don't have religion.
Right.
You yourself are someone who doesn't have religion.
That's correct.
And also, with a science fiction book, sometimes people don't see the forest for the trees. Are you worried that people are going to, for lack of a better term, read too much into what is just essentially a funny novel?
Well, you'd have to give me a specific of read too much into it would mean.
Well, you know, people hone in on, for instance, things like religion. People talk about, oh, he's talking about religion or the lack thereof, and they're not following the story. They're spending too much time in that one aspect.
Ah, well, I can't control that. The book deals with other things besides religion. It deals with genocide. It deals with chocolate. It deals with cheese danishes. But if they're focused on that, if they are upset because I'm critical of religion in the book, I can't control that. All I would say is hopefully you'll read what's there and take from it what you can. If you want to get angry, let me know. It's you know, you can't control that. You may offend somebody. That happens. There's a wonderful, do you know the musical 1776?
Yes.
There's a wonderful line that John Adams' character says after a lot of the delegates to the Second Continental Congress have said, no, wait a minute, we shouldn't insult the king and Parliament, we depend on them, we should tread carefully what we say here, and the people of England, you know, they're our stock, and we should just be very careful. And John Adams finally just, you know, he's had it, and he finally says, it's a revolution, damn it. We're going to have to offend someone. And that's, you know, there's a lot of contention right now on the question of religion, on the question of atheism. It has been brought very much into the forefront by what are called as the Four Horsemen. And that's Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Harris. A lot of books on the subject out there. I didn't write this book in response to that because I first started writing this book back in 1993.
Well, we got just about a minute.
So feelings, and these are thoughts I've been dealing with for most of my adult life.
Well, we've got just about a minute, so I got to ask this question before I let you go, and that is, you've written a lot of books in the past, or a few books in the past. This is the first time into science fiction. Is that a different writing muscle to write a science fiction novel?
No, it's really a novel about ideas, of course, which is what the best of science fiction is. And it's not hard science. The science I have for my aliens are all fanciful. Their technology I call bubble technology. Everything they do happens because of bubbles. They send out communication bubbles, medical bubbles. They travel in bubbles. It's meant to be fun that way. It's meant to be visually fun. And as you know, the book will carry three interior illustrations. Which my publisher was happy to let me do. And I've got a great illustrator named Todd Cronin who's providing that and has also done the cover for the book. So it's storytelling. Everything is storytelling. You know, imagine it, put it down on paper. That's your job as a writer.
The story is Traveling in Space. It's written by Stephen Paul Levin. Steve, I thank you once again for being on the program.
Well, thank you, Peter. I appreciate it. And talking to you in the future.
Stephen Paul Leyva, author of Traveling in Space. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0112, and you'll find links to Steve's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. One of the best-kept secrets about America's justice system is that legal waivers are not the protection we think they are. In fact, they're often not worth the paper they're written on. I learned this years ago when a group of my friends had to end a popular college event. It was called Car Stuff, and students competed to see how many of their friends they could fit into a car. It was a lot of fun, and it had become so big that a major car maker featured it in a national advertising campaign. Even though all students signed a waiver and no one had ever been injured, the event was eventually stopped when lawyers said it simply wasn't possible to write a waiver that would protect us from being sued. Let's be fair. America is known as the land of the free and the home of the brave. But in this age of lawsuits, we're not as free to do things today that we once took for granted. Do you have a similar story? If so, we'd like to hear it. To share it with us, go to our website at centerforamerica.org.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to the authors of Drive I-95. And, of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. But before we get to all of that and our next guest, we have one more Stuff File news story to share with you on the program. And according to a police spokesman, this one is like a bad Samsonite commercial. Monique Exum, age 36, says that a friend told her that if someone dies in your apartment, you go to jail. So she didn't know what to do when her boyfriend, Johnny Davis, age 73, yes, her boyfriend was 73, died in their Bronx apartment. The New York woman thus naturally stuffed Davis's body into a suitcase, which she dragged down three flights of stairs and left on the porch of an abandoned house. It took 3 months for someone to notice the suspicious package and call police. Oh, he must have been so ripe at this point. Anyway, the police quickly tracked the suitcase back to Exum. She insisted it was all a mistake and did nothing wrong, but she's being held on suspicion of improper body removal, and she's also being held for raiding Davis's bank accounts. How much you want to bet there was a name tag on that suitcase? I'm just guessing. She could have been idiot of the day, but we're not sure about the name tag aspect of this whole thing. However, we will get to the idiot of the day in just a matter of moments, a little later on in the show. But first, let's get to our final guests on this edition of the Stuff File program. Back in the summer of 2010, we had Sandra Phillips and Stan Posner on the program to talk about their book, Drive I-95, which chronicles the sights you'll find driving along one of the most popular routes in the U.S., which runs from New Hampshire to Florida, in their book. The husband and wife duo are back on the program to talk about some of the updates you'll find in their latest edition of the book. Hi, guys.
Hi there.
So you're still driving back and forth on I-95, are you?
An endless loop.
And you keep expanding and expanding upon this book. First of all, how many years have you been putting this book together?
This is our ninth year, believe it or not.
Well, we have to finish the road. It ends in Holton, Maine.
Yeah, the next edition that we're researching now will go right to the top of Maine.
So, with the exception of the new things you add to the book, do you find that when you first started this book, you figured, gosh, you know, we've pretty much got it covered, or do you find that you discover new things along the way that you hadn't seen or heard about when you first started doing this book?
Oh, absolutely.
We are flabbergasted by the new things we find each time.
We'll go out and say we're not taking any new stories this time, and we'll come back with 50 new stories.
Just an example, there was a museum, you know, we sort of had done the highlights of Richmond, Virginia, and there was a museum sort of we hadn't gotten to yet. It was a science museum for kids. So we went there, figured, oh, it'll take us 45 minutes to go through and get some notes, and the PR lady says, if you wait till 11 a.m., you could watch the rats playing basketball.
Excuse me?
Yes.
And we did, and there's a video on my site.
So there's terrific things that you wouldn't believe you could see along the way and have fun along the way. New museums have come up. You know, since we were on the road, the Marine Corps built a museum at Quantico right on an exit. New cities have shown up.
Yeah, brand new city. It used to be a forest when we started. It's called National Harbor, Maryland. It's right at the bottom of Maryland facing Alexandria near Washington, D.C.
Wow. Now, with the book being so successful over the last several years, you must also get notes from people saying, oh, love your book, but you missed X, Y, or Z.
All the time.
Yeah, and that's where we get the best insider information. Because we get off every single exit, we ask the locals, people in gas stations, the tourism bureaus, and we get the places where they eat, not the ones you might find in tourist books.
So what are the more interesting or odd things you discovered in the last little while that are in your current edition of Drive I-95?
Well, where are you going to go, Stan?
Okay, I'm going to start with the crazy drive-in church in Daytona Beach.
Okay.
It's right along the Ocean Drive, and it used to be a drive-in, and now you can go in Sunday morning. There's a full-time pastor, and you sit in your bathing suits in your car. And when it's finished, you cross the street and go to the beach.
Cover it all. I mean, that's so Florida. We never knew about medical travel. And there's a couple of places along the way. The Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, has a hotel built into the hospital grounds. So you could say, gee, I need a checkup. You plan it. They organize it all in a couple of days. You stay at the hotel. You go do your checkup. You go home. And that's a whole new kind of travel we didn't know existed.
Another thing, there's two jails along the way that have turned into art centers. They just turned the cells into little art studios.
If people take the auto train, it's in Lorton, Virginia, is where you would get on the northern end of it. And right near there, there's beautiful grounds of a jail, and each of the cells has a different artist in it.
I would assume for people who might drive I-95 a lot, even though your book is a handy guide, the one thing it could be used for by people who frequent I-95 is they could create theme trips, could they not, using your book?
Oh, sure. All different kinds of things. It could be military themes. It could be...
awful lot of history.
Yeah, there's a lot. It could be, yeah, you could do Revolutionary War themes. We just sent out a newsletter about different odd statues. So even if you like art along the way, you could have an art theme. You could do amusement parks along the way. There's all kinds of things you could pick out. And in our ebook, you could actually search by word and then plan your trip that way.
Speaking about history, I think one of the things you mentioned in Concord is Dr. Samuel Prescott and not Paul Revere completed the famous
That's
midnight
right.
ride?
Paul Revere never finished it.
So what happened was a few people left from Boston that night, and Paul Revere was on the road. He picked up Dr. Prescott, who was visiting perhaps a lady friend, and they were caught by the British and detained, and Dr. Prescott managed to get away, and he managed to get to the end and give the message that had to be given. And Paul Revere was detained, so Prescott really finished. It was only because of Longfellow's poem that we think Paul Revere finished the ride.
Well, it's because of the rhyme. What rhymes with Prescott?
Well, right. Also, Paul Revere was, you know, an amazing Minuteman patriot and involved, and I guess maybe he deserved the fame.
Okay. Now, along the way, when you're driving along I-95, you can always find various interesting places to stay. I understand one of them is a converted caboose.
Oh, yeah.
Why not?
That's at the bottom of South Carolina.
And it's actually on a campground, so you would never
KOA
think...
KOA campground.
Yeah, you would never think, I'm going to a KOA campground if you're not a camper. But yet there are, what do they have there, a caboose?
There's a Charleston tram.
And then there's kind of a little Hansel and Gretel wooden hut. And
yeah,
you could,
cabin.
Yeah, the only thing for them, because it's a campground, you would have to have sleeping bags to sleep there, and don't expect to find any bathrooms inside. You have to go to the communal...
But the two, the train car and the tram are air-conditioned.
And the heated in the winter. And very inexpensive.
And very luxurious. Yeah. The
oh,
caboose.
I wouldn't call them luxurious.
For a caboose.
Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, your book goes now from New Hampshire to Florida, and each time I talk to you, it seems to be a greater distance. What is the exact distance, the full length of I-95, and what is now missing from the book so far?
The only thing missing is Maine, and that's 302 miles. So we have just about 1,570 miles, and it'll add another 302 for Maine.
And how do you prevent this book from turning into the size of a phone book?
Well, we cull it each time. In other words, we take out X amount of stories, and then we put in more stories. But when we eventually will be an online edition, we'll put everything back. And we're also going to put the ones we take out on our website for a complete listing. Let's say we take out 50 restaurants on the web. We'll have all the ones we've taken out as well as all the ones that are in this edition.
And I understand there's also a PDF version for iPad folks?
Yep, for iPad or for laptops. Download a PDF.
So people who are traveling, families, you know, you got the computer in the car and you can travel along, and you would get all of the stuff if you use the online version, right?
Yes.
It's the full book.
Yeah, so there's a USB key you could buy. There's a dead tree version, and the ebook version.
With 9 years behind you now putting this book together, is it a different situation now dealing with the tourist boards and whatnot than when you first started? I must assume, just, you know, looking through the book and talking about the book, that the tourist board must just love you.
Yeah, pretty well. They're really happy when we show up, especially because we talk a lot about the small. We haven't talked to the small town America, which makes it so fun when you stop in a little town along the way, and people are so appreciative of you being there. So they're especially happy, and we love to feature because it makes your day so much better when you, let's say, you get to. I'm thinking Walterboro, South Carolina. You go to a small town, and the whole town is full of antique stores. So instead of sitting in your motel at night, you could walk around, meet people, you know, have an interesting shopping experience.
But just to expand on what you said, not only the tourist people, but the everyone in the book loves the fact that they're in the book. They all love us.
Yeah, because we're writing about family-owned businesses, small things, and what happens is you wind up with friends along the way. When you stop in these places, you're going to meet the same people, the same family over and over, and so each time you make the trip, you have somebody to see again, and it makes it that much more pleasurable to travel, and the warmth of these families and the people you meet makes it entirely different than if you stayed in just a plain old motel and ate in a chain restaurant.
How many different ways can people get the book?
Well, they can buy it in a bookstore. They could buy it from us directly. They could buy it on our website, drivebuy95.com.
And, of course, Amazon.
Amazon.
Excellent.
Any place you could buy books, you could buy books. We also have an 800 number.
The book is called Drive I-95, and you can check out the website, www.drivei95.com. Stan and Sandra, thank you very much for being on the program once again. Happy motoring.
Thank you.
Happy trails.
Stan Posner and Sandra Phillips, author of Drive I-95. You can check out the book by going to their website at www.drivei95.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0112, and you'll find links to Stan and Sandra's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order their book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I'll present, the idiot of the day.
A Gannett County, Georgia man is in jail after he robbed a QT gas station right in front of a Snellville police officer. The police officer was standing just feet behind the man as he demanded money from a cashier, as shown on the store's surveillance video. And yes, for your viewing pleasure, a video report is up on the Stuff File website for today's show. And again, that's show number 0112. Police said Stephen Daniel asked the officer for a ride to Lawrenceville, and the officer said he couldn't do it and that Daniel had to use the payphone outside to call someone else to give him a ride. The video shows, after speaking with someone on the phone for a few minutes, Daniel hung up and then walked into the convenience store demanding cash. As the manager of the QT gathers the cash, other customers are still paying for the things they're buying. The video shows that the store manager is smiling throughout the whole robbery as he looks over the robber's shoulder at the cop behind him. As soon as Daniels turned around, he saw Lieutenant B.W. Brown. Says Brown, "I'm standing right behind him. I got a hold of him by the shoulder and placed him under arrest for robbery. It was a comedy type thing." Brown said everyone in the store started laughing. So Brown did get his ride to Lawrenceville, but he didn't get to go where he wanted to. He went directly to the Gwinnett County Detention Center. That's where he remains on a robbery by fear charge. It's called robbery by fear because he didn't actually have a weapon. Now, why would someone decide that it's a good idea to rob a convenience store just minutes after talking to a cop at the same location? Never mind the fact that he doesn't even look around while committing the crime. Oh, one reason and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0112. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And at the website, you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0112. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags and mouse pads. Hope to see see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it for 0112. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.